From national news in D.C. to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol, this is your Capitol Connection. And now, bringing the Capitol to you, here's your host, Nate Gross.
And welcome to another edition of Capitol Connection, brought to you by Walker Tire and Auto Service, broadcasting today from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studios. Glad you're tuning in. A lot to talk about this week, especially on the pro-life front. So I have a special guest joining me today, Chuck Donovan, who's out in Washington, D.C. Chuck is the president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, one of the premier pro-life organizations in the country. He formerly helped lead the Family Research Council for nearly two decades and also served as a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He'll be joining me today to talk about the case of Charlie Gard in the UK, as well as pro-life provisions that everyone should know about in the Senate healthcare bill. In this case that everyone has been talking about for good reason with little Charlie Gard, the 11-month-old baby born with a rare life-limiting condition in the UK, who was ordered off of life support by the hospital and the courts in London, is just terribly tragic and incredibly difficult. But it has really highlighted the issue of parents' rights and the need to fight for every human life. There's just been an outpouring of support for this family from truly across the globe. But there's a lot to take away here, especially when considering who should have the final say here, parents or the government, as a side effect of government-controlled health care. And why is the burden of proof on the parents to have to prove to the state why their child should remain alive and not be taken off life support against their will? And I would rather see cases like this where we err on the side of the parents. But the truth is that the Charlie Gard story is the fruit of a awful, terrible, progressive tree. When this story first made the news and the courts in London ruled that Charlie should in fact be removed from life support, Charlie's parents raised over $1 million to bring their child to the United States for this experimental treatment that could save his life. But again, the hospital refused to release him to his parents so that they couldn't even try. The parents understandably sued, but the courts agreed with the hospital that it was time for Charlie to die. And I'm sure if you're a parent, that probably makes you very angry, because if you're human, that should make you angry. But I think what this is about more than just an isolated story about a very sick baby, because this outcome is what progressives have been fighting so hard for, even if they don't know it. Because this isn't merely parents and doctors with a difference of opinion, and it isn't parents refusing to accept the inevitable. What we have here is the state actually seizing custody from parents, taking away their rights in order to hasten the death of a baby, because they believe that that is the child's best interest, to die. It's the state denying parents the opportunity to try and to expend every possible resource to save their child's life, as slim as a chance that might be. And when you take the position that human life has value only to the extent that it helps other humans, this is what you get. When you take that position that it's only human life when it's convenient or when you want it to be there, this is what you end up with. That this story is what it looks like when the power to make life and death decisions about healthcare is taken away from families and given to government. This is what you get. And I am certainly not convinced that government is better at determining what is good for a child over the child's own parents. Just look at how twisted this is, where we're at a place now in society where we have laws that give a mother the right to terminate the life of her child but prohibit her from trying to keep her child alive. So here we have a mother who wants to keep her child alive, and the state says, nope, you can't do that. It's time for them to die. We've decided. oh, but if the child is in your womb and isn't born yet, yes, go ahead. That is fine. That's Europe. That's progressivism, and we absolutely do not need to let it happen here. And I certainly haven't seen anyone on either side who is happy that Charlie Gard was ordered off of life support against his parents' wishes and their rights were removed. But the point here is that that is the fruit of the progressive tree. And if you don't like the fruit, stop watering the tree. A lot of attention, of course, has also been on the Senate health care bill and what Senate Republicans can come up with and agree to and what possibly will or will not get passed. But there's also some very important pro-life provisions that need to be protected and a part of the health care bill that ultimately gets passed. And so I'm going to talk about that as well with Chuck Donovan of the Charlotte Lozier Institute coming up in just a moment. But first, I do want to thank sponsor of the show, Walker Tire and Auto Service. Whatever your vehicle needs, Walker Tire in Omaha is here to help take care of you. Walker Tire and Auto has been serving Omaha customers for over 6 decades, and only at Walker Tire and Auto can you get free oil changes and more for the life of your tires. Walker Tire and Auto is also featuring free video vehicle health inspections free with each visit. Hear from their expert technicians and see for yourself how your vehicle is doing right from your email or phone. So for all your vehicle service and maintenance needs, visit Walker Tire and Auto, always going the extra mile for you. I'm grateful to have with me now a distinguished guest, the president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, one of the premier pro-life organizations in the country, and the education arm of the Susan B. Anthony List, Chuck Donovan. Chuck, thank you for joining the program. How is everything out on Capitol Hill?
Well, we're in the midst of summer heat here, and the debates are pretty heated as well, but that's kind of a perennial experience here in Washington. We're a little bit used to it.
That's right. And now, Chuck, formerly you were the legislative director for the National Right to Life Committee. You've worked as a writer for President Reagan, helped lead the Family Research Council for nearly 2 decades, and most recently were actually a senior research fellow for the Heritage Foundation. So I think to put it mildly, you have been a warrior in the pro-life movement, and I've been talking a little bit about the case of Charlie Gard in the UK. And I think that this is a case that is troubling to everyone, but what was your reaction to this story when you first found out about it?
Well, I think we had immediate concern about the case. There's justifiable concern about any healthcare system as they have in the United Kingdom, where the government basically controls healthcare. Parents, generally speaking, don't have a whole lot of alternatives. It's not to say that the quality of the care there and the intensive care so far for Charlie appears to have been good, but we have a conflict here, a very basic one, between a determination by physicians that care for Charlie, particularly in experimental care, his parents want, which is not available in the United Kingdom. The government has concluded, and they're backed by the courts, that it would not be effective for Charlie, and we all have questions about what a unitary healthcare system decides is effective care. And then on the other hand, you have the parents who have brought Charlie into the world and are certainly agonized about his condition. And they have researched alternatives and they believe they have the right, if you will, to try them. I think our instinct was side with the parents unless the facts overwhelmingly suggest that they're putting their child through absolutely unnecessary harm. And there's no reason to think that given what we've seen about these parents.
Right. I appreciate that analysis because this really is an extremely difficult but also complicated issue. And sometimes the term slippery slope gets thrown around a lot. Do you think that's what this case is or could lead to, letting the state have this much control over healthcare decisions for children and whether or not they stay on life support and even how they die? The hospital wouldn't let the parents take Charlie home. Do you think that this case is a slippery slope?
I think from a legal standpoint, more strongly than perhaps from a medical standpoint, although you can't really separate the two. But looking at it medically, everyone agrees that the hope for Charlie is in a treatment regimen that has not been tried on the particular type of mitochondrial deficiency that he has, which is itself the underlying deficiency can be ameliorated but not necessarily cured. So medically, it's a pretty difficult one. The parents are, however, as you mentioned, they've asked to be able to take Charlie home if he's going to pass away, if the experimental treatment's not available. And the hospital is saying, no, he must stay here where they want to supervise his last hours. That's where we think the legal precedent, the parents' judgment here, is being overridden, even to the extent that they're not going to be able to spend the last few hours at home holding Charlie. It's going to be under hospital conditions. With that, that's a distressing precedent, we think, even more so than the medical situation.
Right, and so this case with Charlie Gard seems to be an essential intersection between both the pro-life and parental rights issues. And you've done an incredible amount of work on both of these causes. So how in your mind, how do we better advance and make sure we're protecting the right to life and also the rights of parents here in the United States?
Well, I think, of course, we are working very hard to establish the legal rights of the unborn. I think Charlie having a right to life is probably not disputed here. Parental rights, though, are compromised in all sorts of ways. And from my years of working with Family Research Council, the courts in the area of reproduction, abortion, birth control, things like that, have almost carved parents out of the picture. Reversing that's going to be a long process. We talk about reversing Roe v. Wade, but frankly, I think we need an entire effort to reestablish parents as the educators and authorities in the home. And we need to back them up with public policies that support abstinence, that encourage young people to focus on long-term goals, and to resist the siren songs of the, for lack of a better term, the sexual liberators at Planned Parenthood. But, of course, these things are not pending in Charlie's case, but the general weakening of parental rights in these areas is of concern.
And so obviously at the center of this case is the life of Charlie Gard, and that's the most important thing. But does this case show or highlight in your mind one of the problems with a big centralized healthcare system where the government puts a one-size-fits-all policy on everyone and really renders parents helpless over the healthcare decisions of their own children?
I think it does. I think we also, domestically, we have to be aware of the concern that not simply providers of health care or governments, but even insurance companies can be very brutal in this regard. You know, in the United States, we've had reported cases in Oregon, I think we'll have some soon in California, where assisted suicide has paved the way for a denial of end-of-life care that someone may seek that would be more expensive. In the case of Oregon, some specific cases where the government, or, you know, the government has offered the tools to commit assisted suicide that they'll pay for. That's insured. But the longer-term care, the more difficult and expensive care is not. So we have lots of players in these situations. The overall concern is erosion of respect for individual human life.
It's absolutely essential that we're continuing to have these conversations. And so speaking of healthcare, I wanted to be sure to ask you about the Senate healthcare bill. And I know we're not entirely sure how this is going to shake out yet and what we'll be able to get passed. But my understanding is there are some very important pro-life provisions in the Senate healthcare bill that the Charlotte Lozier Institute and Susan B. Anthony List are advocating for. What are those pro-life provisions about?
Well, we have a comprehensive vision. I think that's the easiest way to explain it. That vision includes sending no federal funds to the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. It's the largest abortion provider in the country. We've gathered some recent data that show in several states, for example, Indiana, 73% of all the abortions performed in the state of Indiana are done by Planned Parenthood clinics. So they ought not to be in the vanguard of providing women's health in America. And so all the versions of health care reform that we supported remove Planned Parenthood's Medicaid funding and provide new funding to community health centers that are under community jurisdiction and management, and they are obliged not to engage in abortion or referring for abortion. So that's one provision. The other provisions, there are multiple ones, and it can get really complicated. But our bottom line is that the Hyde Amendment protections enacted by the Congress since 1976 need to be applied to any funding stream that provides either directly for medical care or to any funding stream that would help individuals purchase their own insurance. So that could be through various programs. It could be a tax credit, or it could be through a subsidy program like the Child Health Insurance Program. So the Senate's been wrestling with different forms of supporting the states and supporting health insurance. We've been here to make sure that all of those vehicles and avenues for funding have the Hyde Amendment applied to them.
Right. And, you know, something that we consistently hear when we talk about defunding Planned Parenthood and making sure that taxpayer dollars aren't subsidizing the largest abortion provider in the country is that Planned Parenthood should keep getting this funding because there's already a prohibition on tax dollars being directly used for an abortion. What's your response to that, that Planned Parenthood should keep receiving taxpayer dollars because they supposedly don't use any of that money directly for an abortion?
Well, there's plenty of ways to look at it. A healthcare reform bill is going to provide people with insurance and tools to obtain abortions, or at least potentially it could. So we have to address that. Planned Parenthood, on the other hand, is a marketer of abortions. Anything we do to build up organizationally a Planned Parenthood clinic, to open one in a new location, to expand its other services, to make the initial contact with a teenager where there's no parental involvement, when something inevitably happens with an unexpected pregnancy, and something like 50%+ of the women who have abortions or have an unexpected pregnancy prior to that, they're going to be coaxed and encouraged by those they're already in contact with. And Planned Parenthood has basically integrated abortion as a priority service. I'll give you just a quick comparison. We went out and looked at the market share in other major sectors of our economy. If you're General Motors, which everyone believes would be the lion's share of the automotive industry, it has about 17% of U.S. sales of automobiles, trucks, and so forth. Planned Parenthood, on the other hand, has about 38% of the entire U.S. abortion market. So this is the leader in the industry. It's the only area of their services in which they have control of that much of the market. So everything done to help them and their marketing, their brand recognition, really becomes a feeder into the abortion philosophy of the organization. And taxpayers simply don't and shouldn't be subsidizing that, especially when they can send their money to community health centers, pregnancy care centers, and others that they can firm a life, and also offer women much more in the way of support and services than Planned Parenthood does.
And Chuck, my last question for you here before I have to let you go. You have been heavily involved in the pro-life movement for a number of decades now. And so, you know, based on where we were maybe 20 or 30 years ago and looking at where we are today, are you optimistic about the cause for life and the direction that we're heading?
Well, I really am, because, you know, I have a lot of interaction with the next generation or two. I just had my first grandchild last year. And seeing throughout my extended family, I see diversity of political opinions. Certainly, we have sharp opinions about politics and the president. What I don't see is a whole lot of variation in views about the value of life. I think young people are coming around, whether it's via ultrasound or really seeing on the ground the experiences of women who have abortion, particularly the harrowing chemical abortions. I think people are becoming to see that this is no answer to a problem. Abortion tends to extend the problem. They're painful psychologically and physically for women. They do destroy the life of a baby. We can now all see via ultrasound. I'm as optimistic as I've ever been that we can turn the corner on life and even approach the point in a few years where the reversibility of Roe versus Wade is a very thinkable thing.
Well, that's very encouraging, and I would agree completely. There's just no issue more important than protecting innocent human life, and we know that that starts inside the womb. So thank you again, Chuck Donovan, president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a pro-life warrior. Thank you for your tremendous efforts in our nation's capital and for coming on the program today.
My pleasure. Take care now.
I never grow tired of talking about the pro-life movement. And for more information on what's happening with the pro-life cause here in Nebraska, you can always visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. Nebraska Family Alliance, we are committed to ensuring that life is cherished and protected at every stage of life here in our state. And so if you want to stay up to date with the latest happenings here in Nebraska and what laws are being passed, you can visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org and join the network. There was actually new data released last week that showed the U.S. fertility rate is at a historic low. And this is according to Fox News, this new data that shows the number of births compared to the year before fell by 1%, bringing the fertility rate in the U.S. to 62 births per 1,000 women between the ages of 15 and 44. And this is causing some to fear that the country is headed towards, quote, a national emergency. And experts fear that this historic low could cause economic and cultural turmoil in the future. But according to the Washington Post, some experts are optimistic because the U.S. still has higher fertility rates compared to other developed countries, and that when the economy takes an uphill turn, people will start having more children again. We also got some good news from D.C. last week, where the House passed a sweeping reauthorization of the nation's most comprehensive law to combat human trafficking in a rare but essential bipartisan vote. This is a great bill that passed by a voice vote with no recorded opposition. The bill will allocate $520 million over 4 years towards programs that aim to identify and aid victims of trafficking and prevent it from occurring. Programs covered by the act include educating children on how to avoid traffickers and training certain employers, such as airlines, on how to identify potential victims of trafficking. The bill also calls for both domestic and international efforts to combat trafficking and to prevent the sale in the U.S. of goods made by forced labor. According to U.S. Today, the National Human Trafficking Hotline received 26,727 calls in 2016, and there were 7,572 human trafficking cases reported in the United States. Speaker Paul Ryan said that human trafficking is one of the fastest growing crimes in the world and a sinister enterprise that strikes at the very heart of our communities. He went on to say that this is truly a national problem, and that means it's going to take a national effort to solve it. The House also passed two other trafficking related bills last week, the Enhancing Detection of Human Trafficking Act, which directs the Secretary of Labor to train employees within the Department of Labor on how to identify human trafficking victims and assist law enforcement in identifying victims as well. Also, the Empowering Law Enforcement to Fight Sex Trafficking Act allows law enforcement to use grants to fund anti-human trafficking programs. And fighting human trafficking has actually been a main priority for the Trump White House, and in a statement, President Trump said, "My administration is focused on ending the horrific practice of human trafficking, and the three bills the House of Representatives passed today are important steps forward." These absolutely are important steps. We've continued to make great progress here in Nebraska as well, strengthening our laws against trafficking, as well as finding new and better ways to help victims. But there is still always much work to be done. This issue isn't going away on its own. But neither are we. We'll keep working, and I'll be back next week with more Capital News. Thank you again to sponsor of the show, Walker Tire and Auto Service. Whatever your vehicle needs, visit Walker Tire in Omaha, and the next time you need new tires, be sure you get the Walker Tire Advantage, where you can get free oil changes and more for the life of your tires. And as always, for more information on news relating to family, freedom, and life in Nebraska, you can visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.